The Federal Reserve has withstood a lot of political pressure lately. Can it withstand criticism of its own balance sheet? Welcome to SDPB's In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The central bank held interest rates steady last week. Inflation is still higher than the Fed would like before making another rate cut. Meanwhile, the Fed's balance sheet reflects a quirk of its own structure, a balance sheet in the red. Joe Santos directs the Ness School of Management and Economics at SDSU. He leads the Dykhouse Program in Money, Banking, and Financial Regulation. Here's your Monday Macro. So remind us the groundwork you laid on the last Monday Macro about central bank independence and maybe it not being enough to protect the Fed from congressional or presidential pressure.
Yeah, so that's right. Last time we talked about this central bank independence and its fragility. Mm-hmm. And we talked about ways in which the Fed, maybe in concert with the Congress and so forth, could strengthen its position vis-a-vis political pressures. But we focused on sort of the monetary policy side, the way that it could target inflation, for example, and operate monetary policy in relation to, or as we say, against that goal. This time, what I want to emphasize is this sort of mechanical budgetary feature of the Federal Reserve that folks would be forgiven for forgetting about or perhaps never even recognizing that also contributes to its independence. And it's about the money. And by that, I mean that we know that the Fed creates money and we focus on the Fed's balance sheet, and we can go into that a little bit. We think about what it owns, O-W-N, things like government securities, and what it owes, O-W-E, things like banks' accounts at the Fed, which are liabilities of the Fed. But what we sometimes forget is that there's also an income statement. So what it owns generates interest. The bonds pay interest, and the Fed generates revenue as a result. And what it owes accumulates interest expense, which the Fed must also pay. And so normally, this is actually a very interesting situation. And by interesting, I mean positive for the Fed, because it earns more on its assets than it pays on its liabilities. And so it ends up with what we would loosely think of as positive net income. And here's the kicker. So one, it has enough to sort of carry itself. It doesn't need to go to Congress for appropriations. So that's sort of obviously a power move. But it gets even better. Every week when that net, let's call it net income position, is positive, the Fed sort of rebuilds its capital and does other statutory things. The leftover, it remits to the Treasury. Mm. So it's better than I don't need your money. It's, oh, here, I didn't get around to spending this. Maybe you could use it, right? So it's a real sort of power play for the Fed. At the very least, it means that the Fed never needs to go before Congress. And again, sort of mechanically, who is actually sort of really affected by this? It's us. Because if the taxpayer doesn't have to be taxed in order for the government to do what the government does, that helps the taxpayer. And why would they not need to be taxed? Well, because the remittances were coming in from the Fed. So it's a really interesting feature of the Fed. Bottom line, the Fed earns income. That income exceeds its expenses, typically. There's wait for it, right? Something's coming if we're doing this on the air. Typically, the revenue exceeds expenses. And when they're done doing what they do with that balance, they remit the remainder to the Treasury.
So the Fed does not come with their hands out to Congress and say, give us taxpayer money. They make money. I still don't understand how the Fed makes money.
So they sort of almost literally do, at least in a virtual digital sense, in that when the Fed buys something, and so let's think of a loan, an IOU, a security, much like you and I do. This is entirely relatable, by the way. This part is when they buy something, they collect the something, They own it, again, O-W-N. They, if you will, book it as an asset. So you would do the same thing. If you bought a treasury bond, you would put that away for safekeeping. It would be something you, O-W-N, own. Here's where it gets weird. You would buy it by surrendering, let's say, cash.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed buys it also by surrendering cash, except it creates the cash the moment the transaction occurs. So, again, it's the only institution on planet Earth that books a dollar bill as a liability. They owe it, O-W-E. So the balance sheet is at once very relatable and at once very curious. Relatable, they buy stuff. Not very relatable, they issue money in order to buy it. And they can continue doing this, by the way. This is sort of a balance sheet thing. The income thing is what's sort of upside down right now, and that is at the moment, all this buying they do means they generate interest income, and all of the money they create when it's held by banks means they pay interest on that to banks. The difference is, has been for quite a while now, about 2 years, negative. So they have not had positive net income. It's been negative, which means they have not had the weekly opportunity for the power play to go to the Treasury and say, here, we didn't get around to using this. Maybe you could.
Okay. Before we get into why that is upside down, how long has this been the framework for how the Fed operates? Since the beginning, or have there been changes historically?
Yes. So the budgetary component, the balance sheet, if you will, of the Fed has essentially looked this way. That is the composition since 1913. So it's quasi-public. The commercial banks that call themselves members of the Fed actually own, if you will, capital in the Fed, much as you would own stock in ExxonMobil. The commercial banks own stock in the Fed. So this means the Fed owns stuff. I promise I won't spell that again. The Fed owns stuff, so they have assets. They owe stuff. They have liabilities. And they even have a capital position, a source of funds from, if you will, their stockholders. Of course, this is not of the publicly traded variety and so forth. But they have a very conventional, in that sense, balance sheet. They have assets. They have liabilities. They have capital or equity, as we sometimes call it. Again, the only weird piece is the liabilities are the reserves, as we call them, the accounts that commercial banks keep with the Fed. That's even not that weird, but what gets weird is the Fed can just add to that by creating more reserves.
So why are they upside down?
So they're upside down, and there's some interesting figures that go with this, but they're upside down because, well, sort of two things. What is burning a hole in their income statement is the interest expense they pay, or the interest they pay to the banks that keep accounts with the Fed. And so that means that amount, that dollar amount that they pay out in interest expense is a product. It's two things. It's the amount of accounts the banks have at the Fed, the reserve balances themselves, trillions of dollars. And then it's the interest rate. And in the last few years, both of these have gone up dramatically. That is, buying stuff has meant adding to the bank accounts of commercial banks at the Fed. And so they've been creating these reserves. That increases one part of the product. And then the interest rate that they pay banks on those reserves, they've also increased. So it's the dollar amount of accounts at the Fed times the interest rate, and both those numbers have gone up. And so they pay out hundreds of billions of dollars of interest to these banks, and they just don't earn that on the trillions of dollars of securities that they own. And so they're in that way in the red. It's been going on since about 2002, 2003. Again, weekly, you can see this bar chart, and every week it's in the red instead of in the black. And they're just sort of holding on to this bizarre, arcane thing called a deferred asset, is how they book it. For those in the audience who are accountants, they'll know what we're talking about. But they essentially are just booking this loss and agreeing that at some point this will reverse course and they will pay that all back, and then they can begin to remit to the Treasury again. But estimates are that this will take a while, again, because this sort of two sides of the balance sheet are upside down at the moment.
So it's not a feature, it's a bug, but it's a temporary disruption to how it works. Have we had these upside down balance sheets before?
No. So this is, it's a really good question. This is a really weird bug, but I like that. Yeah, it's not a design feature. The design feature is the power play. But it is the feature that we live with right now. And again, really what it has to do with, I should back up. The reason they pay interest to the banks is not, I want to be real clear here. This is not to sort of fill the coffers of the banks. The bottom line is we've, you know, talked about this before. The Fed targets short-term interest rates. And that interest rate is determined in that banking world where banks borrow and lend from each other. I think of it as like inventory. You know, I didn't end the day with a loan. I ended up with cash in the vault. I lend it to you because you want to close the day with a loan, right? So we trade these reserves back and forth. And there's an interest rate that clears that market. And that's the interest rate the Fed targets. It's the one we hear Jay Powell talk about. It's the Fed funds rate. Reserves, by the way, are nicknamed Fed funds because that's the only way reserves get there is if the Fed creates them. So the Fed pays an interest rate on those reserves so that the rate never falls below it. I mean, the intuition's straightforward. The Fed's saying, look, I don't want you folks trading and charging each other lower than this rate. I want to keep rates a little high. So I'm going to pay that rate. And nobody in their right mind would ever lend for less than that because they could always lend to me, the Fed. So they set this rate to control interest rates in general. But they can't just set the rate. They got to make good on this. They have to pay the interest that that rate implies. And that's been the issue. They've been using this rate on reserves as a kind of operational tool. And there are a lot of reserves in the system. And that rate has gone up as the Fed tightened since the pandemic. And the rest is arithmetic. They owe more in terms of expenses every, you know, year than they collect in terms of income. And, you know, this puts them in an awkward position, not budgetarily, because, again, we're talking about the same institution that can create money. So they're okay in terms of their ability to exist as a going concern. But optically, it just doesn't play well. If you wanted to bring the Fed into sort of political conversations, discourses around their independence and so on, you could get a lot of sort of quick, you know, bumper sticker value out of pointing out, as you put it, this sort of bug in its income statement at the moment. And again, while it doesn't, to me, signal any sort of financial incompetence or inappropriate behavior, it's really a really kind of arcane artifact of operational monetary policy, but it doesn't look great. Yeah. And so a cheap shot could sound something like, oh, you're the central bank, but yet you lose money every year, you know, or something like this.
You're operating at a loss.
You're operating at a loss. You're no longer supporting taxpayers in the way you once were. And again, you know, we've done a lot of these shows, I think, enough to know that these are really very different things. It's monetary policy is operational. It's plumbing. It's not about, you know, primarily transfers to the Treasury. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that you can point to those transfers and say, look, these are windfall gains to taxpayers and you're no longer providing them. That's just not a discussion you really want to be a part of if you're the Fed. So it's an interesting situation we're in right now. We don't think it's going to last forever, but it has gone on for about 2 years, and it's likely to continue for a bit.
And you argue in the Substack post for Monday Macro that this is a key source of political legitimacy. So is the Fed losing its reputation?
This is a case where I think it could scar them a bit. And I should say, as someone who is, you know, pretty unapologetically supportive of the Fed and its operating approach and so on, why would I ever bring this up on the air, no less? I bring it up more to try to clarify the fact that, you know, it's not that they are in some way cooking or, you know, ignorant to appropriate bookkeeping or something like this. It really is a curious artifact of their monetary policy operations at the moment. Again, high interest rate they pay on reserves, a lot of reserves. The two together, multiply them, you get a big number that you owe every week to these banks. But so to make that point so that the vacuum does not get filled with what you just talked about, and that is an argument that this somehow reflects an illegitimacy or, you know, an incapacity to operate and be left alone, unmonitored. Mm. And that's the unfortunate sort of chatter that I think this again, I keep saying, arcane kind of operational artifact of their income statement may invite. And that's unfortunate because I think it's really not about some illegitimacy or inability for them to be financially prudent. It's really not about that. But it looks that way if all you look at is the bottom line.
Right. What turns it around for them?
It's a good question. What turns it around is a monetary policy that is a bit more normalized so that this interest rate on reserves, I shouldn't say the monetary policy, the operational features of the monetary policy doesn't rely to the extent it does right now on this floor. The issue is there are so many reserves in the banking system. The dollar amount in the trillions is so large and exceptional that it's actually not easy to keep interest rates up, right? Because there's just so much of this sloshing around. And so this is where this floor comes in. And they say, okay, if we don't want the rate to fall below 3, here's one sure way to ensure it won't. And that is we will pay 3, right? And then nobody in their right mind will lend for less than 3. So they use this as a way to keep rates up in this situation where the money markets are awash in these bank reserves. So what will reverse this will be if they don't need to rely on this floor in this way, and if the amount of reserves in circulation are not as large, right? So you need to lower that interest rate, or you need to lower the quantity on which you pay that interest rate. And that's what I mean when I say kind of operational normalcy. But right now, and folks can see this if they look at the figures, the amount of reserves that are out there in the banking system are just enormous post-financial crisis, post-pandemic. The logic at some level is very straightforward. It's just, look, when things are going really badly, the dominant strategy has got to be more cash than less. And so they've sort of kept markets very liquid for very long. And that has led to this sort of odd operational, you know, intricacy. But there's one very simple feature of it, unfortunately, that can fit itself on a bumper sticker. And that is they're operating at a loss.
Yeah. All right. So you don't think it really is impacting the underlying structure of the Fed. Is just worth explaining and noting as people try to bring up the bumper sticker
exactly.
In the daily conversation. You're going to understand it more and understand it's not quite as simple. It never is as simple as the bumper sticker, is it? I mean, rarely.
It never is, and I'm so grateful you asked that. That's right. That's a really powerful clarification. It really is a kind of artifact of their operations. It doesn't stop them from paying for salaries and so on. Again, they do, after all, create money, but it puts them in an awkward position.
Yeah. All right. Joe Santos, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.
You can find the Monday Macro blog on the Substack platform. Search for @JosephMSantos. That's our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.